Hello and welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City tick. Joe Markley keeps us ticking. Most recently, he did that as the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. He's here in his old haunt, the WNHH studio, where he used to co-host the program, to update us on his adventures. Welcome back, Joe. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been a long time, and I've missed it, Paul.
You don't look like someone who's been through a war.
No, well, it's a good. I'm temperamentally low key, and it's only gotten more that way as I've gotten older, which is a good thing if you're in politics.
So, I had a sense that maybe you had more fun running for office than everybody else who was running this year.
Well, maybe less pain. Let's say that.
And why is that?
Well, I'm a fatalist by nature. And there's nothing, if you want to run for lieutenant governor, it's a good attitude to have, because you only have so much control over the outcome. I've said to people, I would have felt, I would have been embarrassed if I had lost the primary. I thought that that was mine to win. But once I was on the ticket, all I could do was try to make my percentage difference. And in the end, the choice is, people are voting for the top of the
ticket. They vote for the governor. They don't vote for the lieutenant governor.
Yeah. So, I felt that I could help, and I helped as best I did, and I was very hopeful right up to election evening as the results were coming in, and it just wasn't there for reasons that I suspect we're going to discuss.
Yeah, and elections, especially close ones like this one, a lot of elections are close these days. They obviously have a lot to do with how the candidates run, but they also have to do with factors beyond a candidate's control, the economy, Donald Trump and Daniel Malloy in this election. But I'll tell you, journalists, we now have a great record of predicting every election wrong.
Yes.
It used to be we got most of them wrong, or wrong by the margins. Like, I thought you were not going to get the lieutenant governor nomination because I'm not a Republican and I live in Democratic New Haven. So I thought, how are the Republicans not going to nominate Erin Stewart? You know, she's in a city that gets tons of Democratic votes, Latino votes, labor. And she's young, and she's a woman, and she obviously was a little inexperienced, and she made some pretty big miscalculations about what to run for what, when to run, what to run office to seek when, and she giggled a lot and all that kind of stuff. But she didn't even come in second. I mean, she in your race, right?
Oh, she did. Oh, she came in second, yeah. Okay. Jamie Stevenson was third.
And then I thought, well, you're going to win the election, Joe. I'm going to know the lieutenant governor pretty well. Because I thought, people were upset with Dan Law, they're upset with taxes, I knew they were upset with Donald Trump, so they want to take that on the Republicans. But you had a very, very weak candidate in the Democratic side for governor who it seemed like when he spent money, he'd lose votes in terms of the ads he put up. And you had this disciplined Republican candidate who didn't tell much about himself, so people might have worried, like me, what don't we know about this guy? But he was on message. He projected and had a record that said he knew how to accomplish stuff and just work with people, very task-oriented. And so why was I so wrong, Joe Markley?
Well, let's take the first case of the Republican primary. I think that what people don't realize is I don't believe in primaries that the party voters vote strategically looking at the election necessarily. I don't think they're sitting
right. You have to appeal to the base in the primary, and I don't know if it's so long or true that you have to go in the middle to get the general election, because now people seem to be going more for authenticity than for ideology. I mean, you look at Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump; they had some of the same voters.
Yes, and I firmly believe that. I don't shift anywhere for anything.
I
believe what I believe, and my attitude is I want to sell what I believe rather than back away from it.
But you see elections partly in politics as a way to advance ideas.
Yes.
Which is not the general idea of politics. Politics generally, that becomes a, don't you agree that ideas and debate and issues become sort of like the way cigarettes were nicotine delivery systems for companies that just wanted to sell nicotine? Politics is the battle for control of power and resources, and that most people in that game use ideology to motivate people. And sometimes they're motivated by that, what they do with the power, but that candidates like yourself who are motivated by a coherent set of ideas and are in public life, sometimes in electoral politics, sometimes not in electoral politics, because you have a set of principles you believe in, are not the norm.
Well, maybe not the norm, but I think it's desirable. And I think that we owe it to the voters to present them with a coherent philosophy so they can make an intelligent choice about what they're getting.
They also can read, I believe, whether you believe it. So, like, people believe, Bernie Sanders believed
that's right
what he said, even those same voters who might have voted for Trump, whereas with Hillary Clinton, they believed it was kind of phony and put on.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I think that the success I've had in my district back in Southington in that area, and the success that my friend Rob Sampson had in winning that seat that I vacated very easily, indicates that people will respond to candidates that they feel are being honest, and that it's possible to move the voters if you preach the gospel to them. You know, if you say, I'm not going to chase the voters where they're going, I'm going to try to convert them to what I believe in and put it in the right terms.
Did you convert anybody to libertarian conservative politics in this election?
I don't know that I did in this election, but I did. I feel that over 8 years in Southington,
well, I wonder whether you have a more intimate relationship with constituents.
Yes,
when you're a state senator, and then when you're at the Capitol, you know, you got 36 members of the Senate.
Yeah,
so you're one of only 36, and then you have quite a voice there as well.
Yes,
whereas your lieutenant governor, you know, most people didn't even know if they were voting for you or not, right?
No, and people didn't even people that were involved in politics would say to me, and now, you know, can you win and Lamont win? He had to explain no. But partly because in this new model that we have, as effectively people are running independently for governor and lieutenant governor. And
in the primary.
In the primary, and then you're tied together.
You have shotgun marriages like Corrine Ghanem.
Yeah. But that was, that confused people into thinking that that the offices as they are in some states are elected independently, which they're not.
Yeah.
So there's only so much that you can come across. And of course, I'd say that as lieutenant governor, like running for vice president, it's first do no harm. You don't want to be somehow a drag on the ticket. You
like
don't
when Tom Eagleton, vice president, when the psychiatric records got released. Yeah,
and Quayle, who I think had got a bad reputation at he some did. Point and so yeah. forth, were probably a harm to the ticket. So there's nothing wrong with putting a Dick Cheney or an Al Gore. You'd say, well, I remember when Clinton put Gore on the ticket, people saying, what do we need, a second Southern Democrat.
That was very interesting when they did that.
Yeah, but I think it was effective. And then you say, well, is Gore a likable guy? Is he a good speaker? He's got some political talent.
No, so don't you have to think, can this person be the governor?
That's right. That's right. You have to.
Because that is your number one job as a then governor, be able to walk in the office if the other guy dies or goes to jail.
And I said to people repeatedly, of the last seven governors of Connecticut, three of them were lieutenant governors who moved into the job when the governor resigned.
Wow. O'Neill.
And Dempsey.
Oh, okay.
So if you go back to Ribicoff was named to Kennedy's cabinet and John Dempsey took over. So it's not an unusual thing to have happen in Connecticut. You want to have somebody that you feel could step into.
So were you thinking, because you came pretty close, were you thinking, boy, I might be a heartbeat away from running the state of Connecticut as a not super prominent state senator from Southington?
I thought I was pretty prominent.
Okay, that's true. You got a lot of variety.
Of course, I thought about that, but I can't say I thought about it to the slightest extent with desire. If I had wanted that office, I would have run for it outright. It would have been a
sweet Why are you running for lieutenant governor if you didn't really care about winning?
Well, I cared about electing a Republican governor, Paul. That was what I really wanted to accomplish. And I felt that by motivating the base, I could bring them along.
So
and
that
I
was your
organize
job,
them.
Running your base.
And you know, I knew that the Democrats were going to have a great turnout operation. And in fact, they did even better, I think, than
that was unbelievable.
And
we didn't find a single one in New Haven, which had the biggest turnout statewide, bigger than it had in many years in New Haven. We didn't find a single voter who was going to vote for Ned Lamont. They were voting against Donald Trump.
Yes, that's right. And that was a problem for us. I felt that I could put together something, starting with my primary campaign, that could help counter that on the Republican side.
Do you think that happened? Do you think there were more base votes because Joe Markley was on the ticket?
I think it helped some. It didn't help as much as I wanted it to, and it was in part because after the primary, there was a kind of a fumble between going from one campaign to another.
Here
was a problem I feel with the Stefanowski campaign generally, and I understand how this happens, which is Bob, you know, at some point goes down to Washington and the experts down there say, hey, you got to get somebody from here to be your...
From Connecticut.
From Washington, from Virginia, from the Beltway to be your consultant. And he brought in an out-of-state consultant, a guy named Chris Lacevita, who had been Linda McMahon's consultant back in 2012.
Oh, my God, you don't bring Linda McMahon's consultant.
Well, that's what I, that was my opinion, too. I mean,
I think highly Linda McMahon, but not as a candidate for governor. For Senate, that was a
And certainly not disaster. The way the campaign was run.
Yeah.
La Civita came in and basically pushed the Connecticut people out, and his interest was 100% in raise money by TV ads.
And how do you spell his name?
L-A-C-I-V-I-T-A.
Now, it's always easy when someone loses a campaign to say, well, what they did was wrong. And I know that the Republicans in the legislature were upset with Stefanowski for taking some out of state. I hadn't realized he came from the Linda McMahon campaign.
Yeah.
Because I remember when they weren't paying these people, they don't paying to like campaign for who didn't really believe in her. But, and you were the first one who pointed me to this, Joe Markley. You and Tom Scott early in the primary were coalescing around Bob Stefanowski. I was thinking, wow, there are five people running for governor in the primary. Two of them are rich guys you never heard of whose last names begin with S-T-E, Stefanowski and Stemman. Why are Joe and Tom lining up this guy? And one thing I thought he did so well in winning that primary was not having the advice of the Connecticut people.
Right.
But doing exactly what you just said the consultant told him to do is he went early on TV and he had the best TV.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he defined us as the best. Am I reading that wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. I got to say that was a strategy that was set by Tom.
Tom Scott.
Before
he said, go early, go big on TV.
And don't take the public financing, because if you do, you won't have the money early. So Stefanowski put his own money in and raised money and was able to get on TV, I mean, literally months before anyone else.
And somehow that carried over, because I thought he was coming like fourth or fifth, because I didn't meet anyone who was for him.
It was the strategy of a horse race where you say, we're just going to jump out to the lead and try to hold it wire to wire.
And then he didn't copy that strategy in the general, and he's probably correct on this too, right? Is that you got a bigger window of time where people just, they're going to focus at the end, not as much, and it's just going to be you against Lamont with Oz Griebel as the third party candidate, so it's not like you need that name recognition. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you're going to have, in the end, the name recognition is never the problem once you're in the general election.
Right.
People are going to know your
name.
So
he didn't do the same strategy of going early on TV to define the race.
Well, he was on TV pretty much the whole time, and he had the assistance of the Republican Governors Association and some groups like that that were thought they had a chance here and put a lot of money into it. I think the mistake is, I was on the radio last week in Waterbury, WATR, one of these little neighborhood stations, and they said, why did he lose? I said, because he didn't put any ads on WATR. But I did feel, honestly, that what he didn't have was a 169-town strategy.
He didn't come to New Haven.
Yes, and you have to say, okay, there's some votes to be gotten
in
New Haven.
And he had some roots in New Haven.
Yes, that's right. And if you can
New Haven,
work selectively.
Where he got cream more than anywhere else.
And this is where the out-of-state consultants are blind. They just look at Connecticut as a big block. It's funny, when you work with out-of-state consultants, Paul, they're obsessed with counties. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep saying to them, there's no such thing real to speak of politically as a county in Connecticut. Just forget it. And it really is 169 towns. And when I mentioned Waterbury, I mean, there's some very popular Waterbury Republicans that Stefanowski could have tied himself to. And you'd say, could we get 500 extra votes in Waterbury? Could we find 300 votes in the annex in New Haven? You know, if you know where to look, and you know how to reach people.
And retail politics, he was better at it than he didn't even show up for his one event on a schedule in New Haven. He was supposed to be at a Halloween party, and we sent someone to it on Upper State Street, and he didn't show up.
He was good when he was there.
Yeah.
Now, one problem he had, and this was just in the nature of the campaign, you can't blame anyone for this, but because he was a old style candidate, which is he put in some of his own money and he raised money, he spent a lot of time on the phone at fundraisers, etc.
He was also kept away from the media.
Yes.
How do you feel about that strategy?
I think that was I'm completely against that strategy.
So mistake one was he didn't do a 169 town strategy.
I think that's part of it. I would say another mistake was he didn't pick up on what we had to offer in terms of a ground game quickly enough. By the time he did, we had lost weeks. And a third thing was I would say staying away from the press, and I would say especially radio and TV.
Yeah, he didn't want to come here.
And you know, I mean, it's my job in politics in a way to rush towards the TV cameras. You know, you can criticize people for it, but you want to get your word out there. And TV is great because radio is great because it's your own voice, it's your own face, even if they edit it
And on radio, you don't get edited.
And on radio, you don't get edited. That's right. You can say, okay, I don't want to, what's the point of getting in the New Haven Register? They're going to write the article the way they want to write it. And people aren't really paying attention to the newspapers much anymore anyways. But radio and TV, I think you take every opportunity, and you certainly don't want to give people the impression that you're blowing them off. And they did get that from the campaign in a lot of cases.
Yeah, because I never heard bad about it when he interacted with people.
No, he's good. It's funny. Like Linda McMahon, who on a personal level.
Yeah, she was pretty good.
Very, very good. And La Civita in both those campaigns made a priority out of insulating the candidate. When I think you have a good candidate, put them out
there.
I
remember McMahon. She came here. I interviewed her. I walked around with her, spent a half day, had lunch and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
we're small. You know, we're a small media outlet.
And how else are you going to learn? I mean, after all, you expose yourself in the debates. If you're saying, I don't want to be asked a question about this or that, well, you're going to be on stage with your opponent. So everything's going to come up. So why worry about talking about it? If you're going to have to talk with Mark Davis and Ned Lamont on stage, why not talk with Paul Bass about it on the radio?
What about the focus on taxes? So he said, it's that old joke when they get the consultant talks to you that you're going to answer what you want to answer and what they ask you.
Right.
So what'd you eat for breakfast? No taxes.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think about Korea? No taxes. What do you think of Donald Trump? No taxes. So he did a one-note campaign, which was, I'm going to get rid of the income tax gradually and just cut taxes. And it was believable to people that he'd be more likely to cut taxes than Ned Lamont. And that campaign was run on Stefanowski's terms. Lamont pretended he believed that tax cutting was what we needed to do, even though he doesn't believe that and his voters don't believe that. His consultants told him, you're going to be hit as a tax raiser the way Dan Malloy is perceived, and they're going to keep calling you Malloy. I had thought it was wrong for, it looks like Dukakis in 88 for president, running against what you believe and going on the terms of your opponent, which is why I thought Stefanowski was going to win. So was I wrong about that? Was Stefanowski wrong to have that strategy? Was Lamont right to be a smaller version of Stefanowski? Or was it just that the anti-Trump fervor was so great that was just going to kill any Republican trying to win?
Well, that's a shifting calculus between those questions. I guess I'd say I do feel Lamont ran a good campaign.
Oh, how so?
Well, just what you said. He managed to portray the fact that he portrayed himself as a change
agent.
But
who believed it? Who believed that he cared about cutting taxes and that a 250 business entity tax cut was going to help us get out of $1 billion to $2 billion annual deficit?
I think it was enough to muddy the issues with a slice of the electorate that maybe isn't paying too much attention, but which still decides the election.
The unaffiliated voters, the largest group.
Yeah, and we know that, you know, basically 40-45% are going to go for the Democrat pretty much generically, and maybe something like 40% for the Republican.
Bruce Morrison ran for governor. He got 22%.
Well, with Weicker taking the votes away from him, yeah. But in this case, for the people they were fighting over, I think that Lamont did a good job of getting a chunk of that. And I think Stefanowski, he was almost too disciplined, Paul. You know, I mean, I think you want to give the impression that there's more to your campaign than this. You want to have a center, but usually I would say to a candidate, you want to have three or four issues. You don't want to have 12, but I don't think you want to have one either, especially for governor. I mean, maybe if you're running for state senate where people hardly even notice that you're there, one issue of, so you say, Joe Markley busway, that's not so bad.
Or Tom Scott tolls.
Scott tolls, that's right. But when you're running for governor, I think you need a little more. And he didn't do as good a job of, you know, there was this thing about, oh, you can't get rid of the income tax, and Lamont saying you're going to have to cut municipal aid 52% and so forth. And I think Stefanowski had a hard time giving a very succinct explanation of what he really had in mind, because what he had in mind was not unreasonable. But
what was it easy to, to us? How do you get rid of 40-50% of your revenues?
Well, you do it a little at a time.
Right, he said he could do it over 8 years.
Over 8 years.
But how do you make that up over time?
Only by economic growth, Paul. And if you don't believe that the tax cuts will spur economic growth, then it's bogus.
Right.
But if you do believe it, as I believe it, then it's acceptable. And I mean, it takes fiscal discipline, because if the revenues in fact grow, you have to have the discipline not to spend them, but rather to invest them in additional tax cuts. But I think it's doable, it's aspirational, and I think it's the right direction to move in. And I think that it was a good message, but it maybe was not sufficient all by itself.
How about his decision not to campaign with Joe Markley much?
That was not a decision. It really wasn't.
Ned really went with Susan Bicewitz a lot, and she was very prominent in that campaign.
Well, that's, if the difference may have been that that Lamont and Bicewitz campaigned together so much, not that Bob and I campaigned against
but his campaign so also promoted Bicewitz.
Yes.
They felt she was an asset to the ticket,
which I
agree with.
Well, again, I think that there was some resistance from the out-of-state people who look at Connecticut and say, oh, my goodness, it's a liberal state, and here's this conservative.
It's not a liberal state in state elections.
That's right.
And the other thing is, for governor.
I said to the consultants, look, you're stuck with my voting record if that's an issue. If people want to come after me because of votes, that's a matter of fact. You can't change it. But if you put the more you put me out there, the better people like me because they say, hey, his voting record maybe I don't like this vote, but he sounds like a reasonable person. Mm-hmm. But I got out plenty, and I never felt that it was effective. Nobody ever said stay away or, we don't want you here or anything like that. And sometimes they'd say, would you cover this event or cover that event for us?
But they made a decision not to have you out there with Stefanowski, and their campaign never sent us a single release about Joe Markley.
And I kept myself busy because I've been doing politics long enough. I knew what was useful for me to do.
For a question. Yeah.
And I actually felt that you could cover twice as much ground if you do it separately. So I thought that was a little bit of a red herring, which I don't know who was promoting in the press, but the stories about why aren't Markley and Stefanowski together, it was not really something that was a strategy discussed within the campaign. They didn't do the scheduling generally. It was overseen again by an out-of-state guy, so it was frequently a frustration to say, this is
not. What was the name of his firm?
I don't know what La Civita's firm is. He brought in a couple of other people. He brought in a guy for press secretary from Kansas. And I said at the time, I said, what do you want in a press secretary? You want a guy who knows local issues, and you want a guy who knows the local reporters. What in the world are we getting by hiring someone from Kansas? I'd rather hire Paul Bass for our press secretary. We need somebody who knows what's going on.
Yeah.
It was an attitude that just didn't really wasn't sensitive to the fact that states are different.
Whose decision do you happen to know, and you might not know, and I'm not going to press you on this. The Sunday before the election was a big rally for Stefanowski in Wallingford, and the Reverend Boise Kimber from New Haven is a very controversial figure here who usually gets paid, and this is in public finance records, by Democratic candidates when they run. Obviously was not paid by Ned Lamont in this campaign, and he shows up stumping for Stefanowski. How did that happen? How did you feel?
I don't know. I honestly don't know who made that decision. I will say that I, as soon as I knew that Kimber was sniffing around the campaign,
He said he met with him one-on-one. He met with Stefanowski one-on-one.
Yeah, I understand that's the case. And I as soon as he showed up, I said, Bob, this is not a good guy. I don't have anything. I don't know the man personally well enough to know, but I know his record, and I know that he's been a kind of an operator down here in politics for years. And just, I think that, again, there's Republican insiders who were against Stefanowski up to the primary and then kind of swarmed in on him after after he was the nominee. And I think they saw this as a vehicle to get to an urban audience. I think that it's more of a shakedown.
Boy, was that mistaken. Yeah, yeah. That shakedown on zero urban votes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're shaking down Joe Markley today here on Dateline New Haven and WNHH 103.5 FM, your home for community radio, live streamed at newhavenpennant.org. He ran as the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor and has been, is it 8 years now?
8 years back
State
in the
Senate.
From
Southington. Okay. And so, Joe, just one more thing before we get on to lessons from the campaign. So you were portrayed as an extreme conservative, the most conservative person running ever that people can remember for a statewide office or for governor or lieutenant governor. Should I read you the Ken Dixon column highlights?
Sure, let's hear it.
So Ken said, check out this guy. Back in 2013, he proposed legislation that would eliminate the state mandate requiring fluoride in the public drinking water. I always think of the Sterling Hayden character of General Jack D. Ripper, Dr. Strangelove, when I think of the bill. This year, he voted against a ban on rifles with bump stocks, the kind of weapon that was used in Las Vegas Music Festival massacre. Markley voted against a law that produced health benefits for hundreds of thousands of residents in the Affordable Care Act under a Republican siege in Washington. He was the lone senator to vote against the pay equity bill, which also became law to help women finally get paid at the same rate as men. for the same jobs. He and four Republican senators vote against allowing Dreamers access to institutional aid at state colleges with their own fees. That became law. One of two in the Senate voting against the plan for climate change resiliency. He voted against protections for seniors who contract for reverse mortgages. And the lone Senate vote against the so-called affirmative consent rule, yes means yes, on campus sex assault, which became law. And he voted against the bill, now law, that removed firearms from gun owners who are subject to temporary restraining orders. What did you think when you saw that article?
I thought, yeah, that's accurate. Hey, Paul, you know, the thing about it is, I think you know this. I could go down that whole list and explain why I voted the way I did. And you know, the funny thing about it is that what you get hammered on is not that the vote was wrong, but that you were alone in it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because on one hand, I think we say, don't you want politicians that stand up for what they believe in and that aren't afraid to buck the trend and so forth? But when you do it, you tend to get jumped on about it.
Do you want to pick any of those? Like, yeah, yes means yes. You thought that was unconstitutional with unanticipated consequences?
Absolutely. And I think that there's problems all over the country, and there's going to be increasing pressure to change the way that's set up. Let me say this, sexual assault, this is, you know, I honestly felt
just for the record, you don't support campus sexual assault.
No, exactly. And how could anybody?
So your question is, how best do you reduce it?
And how do you give equal protection under the law? I mean, one of the things about it is, in all cases, the accuser and the accused both need to be treated fairly. And the system that we set up, that we mandated for all universities, public and private in Connecticut, I don't think does that effectively. And I think that it's also a mistake for the state to say, we've got the solution to everyone's problem and we're going to impose it on you. I would like to see schools develop their own strategies and see what works and what doesn't work, rather than have the state.
I know there's an argument going on about whether there's due process from accusers. Does defining the rules yes versus yes means yes? Can't you argue that that will not affect whether accusers and the accused get equal protection? Because you're saying what the rule is, not how it will be applied, right?
Well, but it doesn't. Within that law, it talked about things like what the standard was for convicting somebody, if I can use that word for it. And you know, you have beyond a reasonable doubt, and the lowest standard.
I thought it doesn't have the below.
It defines it as being I can't remember the term now. It's not even clear and compelling. It's predominance of evidence, the same as it is in a civic trial. So if it's 51-49 in the scale, and I think simply to mandate that is a mistake.
So your issue is mandating too specifically rather than letting the colleges figure out how best they're going to stop people from raping each other.
And Paul, also setting up a bureaucratic process outside of the legal system, outside of the police system.
The sexual assault is illegal.
Sexual assault should be illegal and it should be prosecuted. I don't think that we should make it into a separate category, which then is handled by college bureaucrats. And you know, it's funny, I was the only vote in the Senate against it, unless you count the fact that Doug McCrory, a Democratic state senator from Hartford, voted against the same bill as a House member.
Okay.
There were other votes against it, and believe me, there were people that weren't comfortable with that bill, but that did not want to be the lone vote against a bill like that, because just this reason, because you get it thrown at you that, you know, you didn't help on sexual assault.
Now, the ban on rifles of bump stock, is that another case where you feel like that's not going to stop a single person from shooting anyone?
Yes, that's right. But let me get to one other that really is a favorite of mine, which was the first one on that list.
The Dr. Strange glove, the fluoride.
You know, this is, again, my friend Tom Scott came up before in this conversation. You know him well, too. And he's about as fearless a conservative as you could find. When I put that bill in, Tom called me up and said, Joe, don't go near fluoride. Stay away from it. And I said, oh, well, it's just to say it shouldn't be mandated because I don't believe this.
But water is one system, right? We have to have standards for our water because it comes, not maybe where you live in Southington, but in most places we have public water systems.
Well, Southington too. But only 13
sidewalks
states.
Sidewalks too?
Yeah, we have sidewalks. We have roads and stoplights and everything.
Gas stations.
Only 13 states mandate fluoridation of water. The other 37 leave it up to the municipality or to the water company. And, you know, I always feel like it's better to have a situation that opens it up to debate on a local level.
What's your concern? You think fluoride is Because, I mean, the joke is that the Berkshires thought it was a government plot.
I don't think it's a government plot, but I think I'll say this. If somebody came along now and said, I want to dump something in the water, people would be up in arms about it. They'd say, what are you putting a chemical in my water for? This went through in the 50s at a time when if you had a lab coat on, the public basically trusted
cigarettes
you.
Cigarettes are good for you, yeah.
And I think that there's, once I got drawn into this issue and explored it for myself, I found, as I would say, scientific evidence, not online things, but things in journals. There was a study by a Harvard Medical School professor just maybe 5 years ago, indicating that of evidence that fluoride reduces the IQ of school children, for instance.
But they do get fewer cavities.
They get, well, and even that, you know, Paul,
that's got to be true anecdotally, because we just saw the difference. People I know in my family and other families have talked about the difference of who was of age when they got fluoridation and how much fewer cavities they got.
I think that even the advocates of fluoride would say it's much more important to brush your teeth with fluoride toothpaste than it is to just swallow the water.
Yeah.
And anyways.
Oh, that's a good point.
My point is simply that it seems to me like it's a subject that people ought to be able to talk about. And what's crazy about it is you say the word fluoride and the next thing they bring up is Dr. Strangelove.
Right, John Birch.
Yeah. And anytime they read it on Capitol Report, they'd run a picture of a guy wearing a tinfoil hat. And which again, I mean, fortunately, I think I have a reputation.
You've got such a good sense of humor about this stuff. I'm
comfortable with myself,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I feel like people that know me know that I'm not going to go off after some crazy subject. But that's where I just think that, and I almost feel like Ken Dixon ought to know better than that too. That this like fluoride boogeyman.
How about climate change resiliency? Because that doesn't even say it's man-made. It's caused. I mean, I do think it's caused by. That humans have contributed to climate change. There's been climate change since there's been an Earth.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't you want to have planning for resiliency?
Paul, I can't even remember the specifics of that bill.
But is that you didn't want it mandated at a state level for what local communities have to do? You trust local communities to know we're getting more floods and we got to deal with this?
But, you know, without remembering the specifics of what the bill is, I almost couldn't say. I can't say that I doubt that that was the line of argument. It may have been the particular resiliency that they had in mind. And
no, but wouldn't it be that you don't want the state mandating how regions or local towns plan?
Well, that's always a concern of mine. I'm just not sure that that was what was the
heart. Do you believe we're having climate change and that we got to deal with it?
I think that the climate is always changing, and I suspect that there is human activity plays a role in it, and how you deal with that let's say effectively, in the sense of saying the kinds of things that people talk about doing in order to address it are going to be very economically difficult. And there's a trade-off, and you have to have a pretty good, not against making trade-offs, but you have to have a pretty solid sense of what you're getting and what
you're
losing.
Obama's idea was we're going to invest heavily in green, so-called green, environmentally sustainable and even solving environmental problems, industries, and train people like coal workers for those jobs, because that's a dying industry anyway. And the argument there is that the Republicans have lied to people about what can actually be preserved and what we need to do to protect the planet.
I think that there's, when you say we're going to encourage something, it always involves a cost.
Picking winners. Government isn't necessarily right about what industries are going to do well, and then you waste your money creating those jobs and screw up the market.
I had a good liberal friend in college I used to argue with, in fact, a fellow that always reminded me a lot of. And we back in those days, it was arguing about ethanol subsidies. And he said,
You win that one.
Exactly. And this is, yeah. And
that
I mean,
got absurd.
And
that was just about the Iowa primary vote.
In the end, yeah. I couldn't say in 1978 or whenever we were having these arguments why an ethanol subsidy was a bad idea, but I just had a sense that once the government puts its thumb on the scale, and that's always my
fear. And even its effect on agriculture and monoculture.
Oh, terrible.
So, yes, the one reminder from your side to our side is that watch out what you wish for. There are unintended consequences. Sometimes you make the problem worse, such as political action committees. And
Paul, the biggest difference between liberals and conservatives is the fear of unintended consequences. I feel like a liberal says,
we can fix it.
We can fix it. Won't it be wonderful? And a conservative says, how much it will it cost? And
except you say
go
tax
wrong.
Cuts. That'll make these magic number of new jobs and investment materialize. The liberal will say, well, we see a lot of studies where that happens. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes government investment works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, there's a, you know, economic theory is something, I think I'm not an economist. Fortunately, I took one good course on it in college that has maybe been my lodestar ever since. But I do believe, either you believe that tax cuts are, generally speaking, an incentive on the economy, or you don't. And this applies to a lot of things. I was at a forum before the election with a good young man that won a state rep seat there subsequently, and he was talking about the minimum wage, and he said, I'm going up there to fight for 15, and then I'm going to fight for 18, and then I'm going to fight for 23. And I thought, my goodness, if either you're right or I'm right, but if a $23 minimum wage is good for Connecticut, then everything I'm thinking is wrong.
But he's talking 10 years or 15 years.
Oh, I don't know what he's thinking. But you know, I'm sure he'd vote for a $23 minimum wage today if it was before him.
Tax cut to spur jobs really is the flip side of liberal philosophy of using government to mess with the market.
Right? Yes. Yeah. And
you have an ideological vision is people should be able to keep their money. I understand that conservative argument. But and the liberals say there's a greater good that's worth us all contributing to. And we both agree there's true to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, there are targeted tax cuts. Like right now we're giving tax breaks to people to invest in distressed areas. And Amazon is using that in Queens.
Yeah.
And there are areas that do very well, but in some census tract that are described as struggling. So people who are going to invest anyway and make money from the wealthy do it, get to keep extra tax money on the guys that government is helping to create jobs for the poor. So can it be argued, here's a leading question, can it be argued that even on the conservative side, you're also messing with public policy, just doing it in the form of tax cuts rather than tax giveaways, you know, grants, in ways that do have unintended consequences and don't accomplish what they accomplish?
Well, it's one reason that I would be much more, I'm much more supportive of
across the board
tax cuts rather than trying to use tax cuts to force policy. I used to say to people all the time, I sit there in Southington, I've got Waterbury, the brass city on one side, Meriden, the silver city, New Britain, the hardware city, not much brand,
any of that,
not much of it going on. But once those industries grew up in those towns, not because there was government policy, but because there was opportunity. And what we need is to create opportunity and see what happens rather than to try to come in and say, we think that the future is bringing us in this direction or that direction. Mm-hmm. But we don't have opportunity right now for us. I wouldn't, in good conscience, encourage a company to move to Connecticut with the current tax and regulatory burden and the likelihood that that burden is only going to increase.
All right. And we have the opportunity to remind you that you're listening to Dateline New Haven and WNHH, 103.5 FM live stream at newhavenevent.org. We're talking to Joe Markley, our old friend at the station, who just ran as a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor and came close to winning.
Yes.
So in the end, a lot of us, including top Democratic candidates who didn't run for governor, assume this is going to be a Republican year. Up until Election Day, maybe you guys knew better on the inside. A lot of us thought the legislature might go one chamber, both Republican. In fact, you guys got creamed. I mean, near supermajorities in both houses of the legislature and all statewide ticket races going to Democrats. What's that going to mean now going forward?
Well, I think you're going to have a very, let's say, the whole progressive agenda is going to go forward very quickly in Connecticut. I don't
agree with you.
Well, I think
I just got a hedge fund manager as the chief of staff.
Well, I like Ned Lamont. Insofar as I've dealt with him personally, he seems like a very decent man, and I'm sure as
he and Stefanowski both were quite mature about the election results. There wasn't any of that sniping, and Stefanowski didn't contest some very fair votes to contest in New Haven because he saw the bigger picture that he had lost, and I thought they were both gracious to each other.
Yeah, I like Ned Lamont. But I don't think that he's a brawler. And I think that he's going to have tremendous pressure from the legislature to move for a more progressive taxation, for wider tolling for all kinds of things,
you know,
that he may
Democrats
be uncomfortable
don't agree
with.
About progressive taxation. Martin Looney and other liberal Democrats disagree with others like Roland Lamar and the party. They feel like the income tax, they argue that the income tax is so progressive that you get declining receipts at this point from hedge funders and others in Fairfield County, where the other side said that's not true. They often go to states that are charging more for tax, like Massachusetts and New York. So I'm not sure the suburban dominated Democratic legislature is going to deliver on more progressive taxation.
Well, the funny thing is, when we get in a situation where Martin Looney is kind of the resistance to progressivism, I think it shows how far to the left the Democratic Party in Connecticut has gone. And I think, I don't think that this...
Not when it comes to giving money to cities.
I don't think that this is a suburban dominated party, really. I think that over time, that the urban aspect of it has become stronger and stronger, and I think they're going to have a very, and you've got...
So you think Pilot will finally be reimbursed anywhere near the level?
No, that I don't know if that's going to happen, yeah. Because there's only so much money. That's a simple problem. But the temptation would be to say, we could do better on Pilot if we, you know, if did a millionaire's tax, for instance, which is always a popular term. It doesn't just fall on millionaires, but it sure sounds good, right? And you've got you have Josh Elliott in the House, who basically has a kind of a scorched earth policy. Again, I respect it in a way. It's completely on the other side of the world, but he's a true believer, and he's
like
not
you.
Not only does he want to move his agenda, but he wants to get rid of the Democrats that don't support his agenda. I think Matt Lesser, who's now in the Senate, is cut from roughly the same cloth.
Would he have won one if not for that crazy ad against them with the anti-Semitic?
Oh, he would have won. That's a pretty strong Democratic district at this point. Nice candidate against him. My goodness, Paul, that's a story unto itself that I didn't say a word about. I think that was the most inadvertent foul that was ever committed.
No one believes that they sat there, let's do some anti-Jewish thing.
Yeah.
But for them not to see right away, once it was pointed out to them, how this fits into every anti-Semitic trope that's been used for a century or more.
Yeah. Ed Sharma, who I got to know pretty well, really one of the nicest guys I dealt with in the campaign, decent man. I'm not sure he would have known that Matt Lesser was Jewish.
Right, I get that. But what happened once that ad was revealed that way? Why was the state party chair, not Stefanowski, he immediately denounced it, but the candidate himself, they were all holding on to it.
Well, you want to say it wasn't meant to be offensive. I mean, we're very sorry. And we understand,
that.
But it was not Ed's intention to inject
that's not
this
what
into
they
the
said
campaign.
For a few days.
Well, that's maybe what they should have said. I don't know.
Okay.
It's hard to say. Hey, it'll fall too. The other thing about it is you always can kick yourself afterwards and say,
right,
I didn't put it quite right, but I don't think they were trying to.
Well,
they certainly weren't trying to hang on to it.
What I'm trying to figure out is, did the Republicans actually run well and come close in the governor's race, or is there a fundamental problem with how Republicans are running in the state? Like, what happens next with the Republican Party in Connecticut, Joe Mark?
Well, there's going to be a debate, as there often is, about do we lose because we're too conservative, or do we lose because we're not clear enough about where we stand? And I fall in the second category, to circle around to the beginning of our conversation. I feel that we're obliged to stand for something, and I think we're obliged to try to convince people of the merits of what we believe in. The alternative is, if the voters are drifting to the left, is to chase them there. And I don't think you'll ever get left far enough. If that's what they want, there's a party already there to say it.
Far left. But you were clear in this campaign. People had no doubt where the Republicans stood on this statewide campaign.
Well, I think the statewide campaign in that sense may have been more of a success than some of the individual legislative races.
Yeah.
And I felt that some of our candidates in Fairfield County were, let's say, apologists. They were not
proponents.
Was
Trump a bigger factor than Malloy in the end? Because you guys obviously banked on the idea, if we say Malloy enough times, Ned Malloy, he's going to lose. And the other side banked on the fact, if we just say Bob Trump from the beginning to the end, they're going to win.
Trump was, I'm sure, was a considerable factor in some districts, and especially down in Fairfield County. The idea that Scott France, my friend in Greenwich, would lose that
seat. And Tony Boucher.
But Scott, above all, was somebody who's, you just can't fault on a level of his personality, his commitment, and so forth. And I think that that was there was a certain anti-Trump vote there. The other part of it, though, more important than the, I think Trump was more important in motivating the base on their side and getting and turning and creating that army that was against us in this campaign. And Chris Murphy, who's also a very smart politician, took the opportunity to pull together the coalition on the left and to organize them and to coordinate them and put resources into it. And in that sense, it was a much, much better operation. And I think Trump gave them that opportunity and they took advantage
of it. So was Trump more important factor than Malloy?
Probably. And the trouble, too, is it's a little hard to deal with Trump as a Republican, because on one hand, there's aspects of him that I think make people very uncomfortable. And on the other hand, there's some policies that you'd say...
He's delivered policy you guys have only dreamed about that your own Republicans couldn't pass in the past, from the Supreme Court that's now going to have a generational lockstep with the Federalist Society to...
The tax cuts and regulatory changes.
Gosh, environmental regulation, putting the coal lobbyists in charge of the EPA. I mean, wow.
So you have to try to thread a needle. And, you know, again, I feel like the way to thread a needle is to be honest about it, to say... Yes, I'm very uncomfortable about the man and his and in some ways his behavior in the office and you know, there was a lot of talk about this because of the death of President Bush, but the difference, President Bush was not a man I agreed with down the line either. But you couldn't fault him.
How do you feel about Donald Trump? Do you support him?
I certainly voted for him, and I do support what he's doing. I wish that he were a different character. It's a sign of our times that people were so desperate that they responded to somebody who they didn't want a politician and they didn't get one.
I also think he understood how to connect with the voters he needed.
Tremendous.
He knew where to campaign in those last weeks more than the smartest people in the room with the Clinton campaign who didn't center to Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania.
And he had already found out how to be a communicator.
So moving forward, where's the party go? Like, we're seeing now the demise of my favorite magazine in America, the Weekly Standard. And some people argue that's because they were never Trumpers. They were intellectually honest conservatives. Others say it had to do with other factors. They're too boring to go and hear about the insides of publication companies. But the Republican Party has become the Trump Party. What does that mean moving forward in Connecticut nationally? What do you think needs to happen?
Well,
I agree with that trend.
I think Trump is a phenomenon that's going to pass through the party without necessarily leaving it tremendously different.
Like, I'm talking like trade. I'm sure you disagree with his tariffs, or maybe I shouldn't be sure of that.
I'm not. The free trader that you might assume.
Yeah,
okay. I mean, that's one of those things over the years. It's funny that also tends to be, if you're far enough left or you're far enough right, you know, the Republican Party used to be
Steve Bannon and the American Prospect were together on China.
Steve Bannon is not necessarily the guy I want to be.
But immigration, his policies are very different from traditional conservative positions.
Again, I don't know about traditional conservative positions. I guess I'd say Republican positions, influenced in a lot of ways by the business aspect.
So are you with Trump on immigration?
I do feel like we have to secure the borders, Paul. I think that you secure the border and then you decide what you want to do. It doesn't mean you keep everyone out, but it means you have to control them. And this is inarguable to my mind. I almost don't know.
He says we want to have immigrants from Norway, but not Latin America.
I think we have to have immigrants from everywhere. And the trouble is, if the borders are open, basically we're saying if you come in from the south, as many people can come in as possible. No one's crossing. You can cross the Rio Grande. You can't cross the North Atlantic.
It seems like a long time ago, but it wasn't a long time ago that the Democratic Republican consensus in Washington was to secure the border but allow more immigration.
Yeah, I don't think that would be a bad trade-off. If we could get it, I'd say, but I think secure the border and there should be no debate about that, and then you decide where to go.
So what's going to be next for Joe Markley? I'm sure you're not going to be fading away.
Well, I might fade a little bit. I'm hoping, as I said, I hope I'll get back. I've been seeing a lot of concerts down here over the last couple of weeks, which is a nice change, and I hope I'll be back writing for the New Haven Independent.
I hope so. We love when you have your art reviews in the New Haven Independent.
Yeah, it's a great publication.
But are you going to be back in the political game?
I will be involved somehow, and I'm looking for a way to be able to pay my rent and still remain active in politics, because there's a lot of building to do in the Republican Party, and a lot of it that has to happen in New Haven and in the other cities.
Well, you talked about 169 town strategy. Tell me about that. Well, and would Aaron Stewart represent that?
I think Aaron Stewart is going to be a figure in the future of our party. I don't agree with her on everything, but she's a talent, and she's got a constituency, and she's got a record in New Britain that she can run on. I think we have to build the party in the cities. I think that New Haven Republican Party recently has been doing an excellent job of making progress, of putting up good legislative candidates and getting them funded.
It's gone way backwards in New Haven. You had this dynamic chair, and then he was done. He got all these new people involved. He got Republican influence on commissions, and now they got this person who has that attitude that you don't talk to anyone but right-wing people because you can't trust them.
Yeah, I've worked with the new chairman, and I like what he's doing within the party. I don't know what his attitude is, broadly speaking.
I'm not talking about the state party.
I know. Jonathan Wharton was a blessing to us, and I'm sorry he didn't stay in there, but I think we're still making progress in New Haven.
How do you measure that progress?
Well, three legislative candidates that got matching funds.
But they got no votes.
Well, but we've got to get the message out there. Step one is not winning elections.
But they didn't get
election.
The message. They refused to be interviewed by any media. The chairman told them not to talk to a single reporter. There was one who defied that, and he was a very attractive candidate. But they didn't get the message out. They thought they shouldn't talk to anybody.
Well, we started the conversation with this. I talked to everybody, and that would be my advice. And the more you talk, the better you get at it, too. That's the way you get practice. Well, I enjoy it, and I'm comfortable. There's not a reporter I'm really uncomfortable with in the world. So
Well, I'm so happy you came here.
Yeah, my pleasure. I got some time, I'll do it again.
I have faith that you're going to be back in the fray, and I hope you are.
Thank you very much.
Because we have
Paul.
A better state the more we hear from Joe Markley. Thanks for joining us on WNHH's FM on Dateline New Haven today. Thanks to Joe Markley for being back in the game. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing "I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free" from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Fly free with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.